You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. Lecture 4 of Practical Advice to Teachers by Rudolf Steiner, given it on August 25th, 1919. Building on ideas we just discussed in our session on general education, I would like to start with a detail of method that is exceedingly important. This detail is also related to our recent discussions of various teaching methods. Footnote, see first four discussions in Discussions with Teachers and Lecture 4 in the Foundations of Human Experience, and footnote. You must regard the first lesson you have with your students in every class as extremely significant. In a certain sense, a far more important element will emanate from this first lesson than from all the others. Of course, the other lessons will then have to be turned to account so that the substance arising in the first lesson becomes fruitful for all the others. Let us imagine in practical terms how we shall shape the very first lesson, for soon you will be making the acquaintance of the children, who will bring with them the consequences of every kind of upbringing, both good and bad. Naturally, I can make only general suggestions here, which you will be able to develop further. The point is that you will not have to follow the misguided educational principles that have been prevalent lately. You must concern yourselves with whatever has genuine significance for the child's development. You are faced, then, with a class of all sorts of children. The first thing to do is to draw their attention to the reason they are there in the classroom. It is very important that you should speak to the children somewhat in this vein. Quote, "You have come to school, and now I am going to tell you why you have come to school." Unquote. This act of coming to school should immediately be drawn to their attention. Quote, "You have come to school in order to learn something. You have as yet no idea of all the things you will be learning in school, but there will be all sorts of subjects that you will have to learn. Why will you have to learn all sorts of different things in school? You no doubt know some adults, some grown-up people, and you must have noticed that they can do things that you cannot do. You are here so that one day you will also be able to do what grown-ups can do. One day you will be able to do things that you cannot do yet." Unquote. It is most important to work through this network of thoughts with the children, and these thoughts lead on to yet another matter. No teaching can flow in the right channels unless it is accompanied by a certain respect for the previous generation. This nuance must remain in the realm of feeling and sensing, but we must nevertheless cultivate in the children, by every means, respect and reverence with which they look up to the achievements of former generations and to what they are also meant to achieve by going to school. We must from the start arouse in the children this way of regarding the culture around them with a certain respect, so that they see those people who are older as somewhat higher beings. If this feeling is not kindled, there will be no progress in teaching and education. Similarly, no progress can be made if we do not bring to consciousness in the children's souls what they can expect. Proceed to reflect with the children, without hesitation, that you are looking beyond their horizon. It does not matter, you see, if you say a great deal to the children that they will understand only later. The principle that dictates that you teach the children only what they can understand and form an opinion about has ruined much in our culture. The very well-known teacher of an even better-known contemporary personality once boasted of having educated his student according to the following principle. He said that he had trained the boy well, for he had forced him always to form an immediate opinion about everything. Many people today agree with this principle of forming an opinion without delay, and it is not remarkable that this teacher should stress the wish to emphasize it in books on education. With regard to this principle, I have come across the statement in a modern work on education that we can only hope to provide such exemplary education for every German boy and girl. You will gather from this notion that you can find in modern works on education a great deal of what ought not to be done. For there is a great tragedy in this kind of education, and this tragedy is in its turn is linked with the present world catastrophe. Footnote, the effects of World War I. End of footnote. The point is not that children should immediately form strong beliefs about everything, but that between their 7th and 15th years they should learn out of love for their teacher, out of a sense of the teacher's authority. For this reason, the suggested conversation with the children, which you can expand on as you wish, should continue along the following lines. Quote, "Look how grown-ups have books and can read. You can't read yet, but you will learn to read. When you have learned how to read, you will also be able to take books and learn from them as grown-ups learn from them. Adults can write letters to each other. In fact, they can write down anything they like. Soon you will also be able to write letters, because you will also learn to write. Besides reading and writing, grown-ups can also do arithmetic. You don't yet know what doing arithmetic means, but you have to be able to do arithmetic when you go into life, for instance, if you want to buy something to eat or to wear, or if you want to make something to wear. Unquote. This is the kind of conversation you must have with the children. Then you say, quote, you will also learn to calculate. Unquote. It is useful to draw the children's attention to this thought once, and then, perhaps the next day, draw their attention to it again, so that you repeat the idea a number of times. It is vital to raise to consciousness what the children will learn in this way. It is most important in teaching to become aware, parenthesis, if I may put it this way, parenthesis, of what otherwise remains a force of habit in life. In contrast, there is no advantage in bringing all sorts of things into the lesson simply for their own sake, even when it seems to serve the lesson. You may hear someone recommend that children should bring a box full of used matches to school so that they can be taught how to make patterns with them. Of course, the matches should have a square shape, if possible, not round, so that they stay on the slanted desks. Children may be taught, for example, how to arrange the matches in the shape of a house, and so on. Organizing matches in this way is a favorite subject and generally recommended for small children. But rather than offering any real understanding of life, such lessons offer nothing but amusement. Learning by arraying matchsticks in patterns means nothing for inner human nature. Wherever such an activity may lead in later life, people can consider it merely a form of recreation. It is not beneficial to merely introduce play into education. On the contrary, it is our task to bring the fullness of life into education. We should not bring in things that are no more than a diversion. Please do not misunderstand me. I am not saying that play should not be used in education. I mean that games artificially constructed for the lesson have no place in school. There will still be a great deal to say about how play can be properly incorporated into the lessons. How can we work effectively right from the start, particularly in forming the will? The time will come to move on to another matter once there have been enough discussions with the children, as I have outlined. That is, discussions about ways of helping children become more aware of why they come to school, and ways of helping them come to respect and admire adults. Then it becomes useful to say something like, quote, look at yourselves. You have two hands, a left one and a right one. These hands are for working. You can do all kinds of things with them, unquote. In this way, you also make them aware of what concerns them as human beings. The children should not just know that they have hands, but become aware of their hands. Naturally, you may be tempted to say that the children are, of course, aware of having hands, but there is a subtle difference between knowing that they have hands with which to work and never having that thought cross their minds. Having spoken with the children about their hands and about working with them, we then proceed to let them do something skillful with their hands. This might even take place in the very first lesson. You might say to them, watch me draw this, drawing on left a straight line up and down. Now take your hand and draw it too. Then we let the children draw what we have drawn as slowly as possible. Actually, it will be a slow process if we call the children up one by one to the blackboard, letting them make their mark on the board and then return to their seats. The most important is that they should digest the lesson properly. Then you might say to the children, quote, now I am going to draw this, drawing on the right, which is a half moon, just a curve, half moon curve. And you can use your hands to draw it too. Unquote. Each child then draws this as well. When they have all finished, you say, quote, this one is a straight line, and this one is a curved line. With your hands, you have just made a straight and a curved line. Unquote. You can help the clumsier children, but you should see to it that each child does it as perfectly as possible from the start. Right from the start, we let the children do something, and we must make sure that in subsequent lessons, this is repeated a number of times. In the following lesson, for example, we let the children make a straight line and then a curved line. Let us consider a subtle distinction. You need, at first, attach no great value to letting the children make a straight and a curved line from memory. Once again, you first make the straight line on the board and let the children copy it, and the same with the curved line. Then you ask individual children, quote, what is that? Quote, a straight line. Quote, what is that? A curved line. You use the principle of repetition by letting the children copy the drawing. and then without repeating it yourself first, letting them name it themselves. It is most important to use this subtle nuance. You must make great efforts to cultivate the habit of doing the right things in front of the children. The educational maxims you believe in must become second nature to you. You need not hesitate quite early on to take out a box of paints and set a glass of water beside it. Indeed, it is a good idea to conduct such lessons quite soon with the children. After you have pinned white paper to the blackboard with drawing tacks, you take up a brush, dip it in the water and then into the paint, and make a small yellow patch on the white surface. When you have finished, you let each child come to the blackboard and make a similar small patch. Each patch must be separated from the others, so that in the end you have several yellow patches. Then you dip your brush into the blue paint and put blue next to your yellow patch, and you let the children come up and put the blue in the same way. Put on the blue in the same way. When about half of them have done this, you say, quote, "Now we shall do something else. I'm going to dip my brush in the green paint and put green next to the other yellow patches," unquote. Avoiding as well as you can making them jealous of one another, you let the remaining children put on the green in the same way. All this will take time, and the children will digest it well. It is indeed essential to proceed very slowly, taking only a very few small steps in the lesson. The time then comes for you to say, quote, "I am going to tell you something that you will not yet understand very well, but one day you will understand it quite well. What you did at the top, where you put blue next to the yellow, is more beautiful than what we did at the bottom, where we put green next to the yellow." This will sink deeply into the children's souls. It will be necessary to return to this thought several times, but they will also puzzle away at it themselves. They will not be entirely indifferent to it, but will learn to understand quite well, from simple, naive examples, how to feel the difference between something beautiful and something less beautiful. A similar method can be used when you introduce music into the lesson. It is good here, too, to start with one note or another. There is no need to tell the children the name of the note. You simply strike the note in some way, then let the children strike the note, too, so that here you also bring the will element into the lesson. Afterward, you strike a second concordant note and then allow a number of the children to strike it, too. The next step is to strike a note followed by a discordant note and again have the children do the same. Just as you did with the colors, you try to awaken in the children a feeling for the concordance and discordance of notes. You do not talk to them about concordance and discordance, but speak of the beautiful and the less beautiful, thus appealing to their feelings. These examples, and not the letters of the alphabet, are the proper starting points for the early lessons. Let us turn our attention to the class teacher. The class teacher will hold, with the children, the conversations I have just described. Perhaps the musical element will have to be treated separately and introduced to the children in another lesson. It will then be beneficial for the music teacher to conduct a similar conversation, though oriented more toward the musical, and to go over the same ground more than once. In this way, the children will discover that the same lessons are repeated by one teacher after the other, so that they will find that they are learning the same from both teachers. This method will help give the school a more unified and cooperative character. In their weekly meetings, the teacher should discuss these lessons so as to instill a certain unity in them. Only when you have taught the children in this way to use their hands and ears is the time ripe for progressing to the first elements of reading, in particular, reading handwriting. Parenthesis, we shall pay greater attention to the details later. Today, in this preparatory talk, I want to suggest the points of view according to which we can proceed, rather than pedantically examining one aspect after another. Parenthesis. With respect to method, it will have had an extraordinary good effect on the children to have spoken to them as early as the first lesson about writing, reading, and arithmetic, and about how they cannot do these things yet, but will learn them all in school. As a result of this discussion, a certain hope, wish, and resolve will form in the children, and through what you yourself do, they will find their way into a world of feeling that in turn acts as an incentive to the realm of the will. As an educational measure, you do not present the children directly with what you want to teach them. Instead, you leave them for a while in a state of expectation. This has an extraordinarily positive effect on the development of the will in the growing human being. Before delving into these matters in more detail, I want to dispel certain ideas you may have that could cause confusion. So many sins have been committed through the prevailing methods of learning, reading, and writing, especially in teaching what is connected with learning to read and write, that is, language, grammar, syntax, and so on. There has been so much waywardness in this area that there are doubtless few people who do not remember with some horror the lessons they had in grammar and syntax. This horror is quite justified. We should not conclude, however, that learning grammar is useless and should be gotten rid of. This would be a completely erroneous idea. In seeking to find what is right by going from one extreme to the other, it might be natural enough to come up with the idea that we should do away with grammar. Let's teach the children to read by the practical method of selecting passages for them. Let's teach them to read and write without any grammar. This idea could arise quite easily out of the horror that so many of us remember. But learning grammar is not an unnecessary practice, especially in our day and age. I will tell you why. What you do when you raise unconscious speech to the grammatical realm... Excuse me, read that again. What do we do when we raise unconscious speech to the grammatical realm, to the knowledge of grammar? We make a transition with our students. We lift speech from the unconscious into the conscious realm. Our purpose is not to teach them grammar in a pedantic way, but to raise something to consciousness that otherwise takes place unconsciously. Unconsciously or semi-consciously, human beings do indeed use the world as a ladder up which to climb in a manner that corresponds to what we learn in grammar. Grammar tells us, for instance, that there are nouns. Nouns are names for objects. For objects that, in a sense, are self-contained in space. It is not without significance for us that we find such objects in life. All things that can be expressed by nouns awaken us to the consciousness of our independence as human beings. By learning to name things with nouns, we distinguish ourselves from the world around us. By calling a thing a table or a chair, we separate ourselves from the table or chair. We are here, and the table or chair is there. It is quite another matter to describe things using adjectives. When I say, the chair is blue, I am expressing a quality that unites me with the chair. The characteristic that I perceive unites me with the chair. By naming an object with a noun, I dissociate myself from it. When I describe it with an adjective, I become one with it again. The development of our consciousness takes place in our relationship to things when we address them. We must certainly become conscious of the way we address them. If I say a verb, for example, a woman writes, I not only unite with the being in relation to whom I used the verb, I also do with her what she is doing with her physical body. I do what she does. My I-being does what she does. When I speak a verb, my I joins in with what the physical body of the other is doing. I unite my capital I with the physical body of the other when I use a verb. Our listening, especially with verbs, is in reality always a form of participation. What is at this time the most spiritual part of the human being participates. It simply suppresses the activity. Only in eurythmy is this activity placed in the external world. In addition to all its other benefits, eurythmy also activates listening. When one person says something, the other listens. He engages in his capital I with what lives physically in the sounds, but he suppresses it. The I always participates in eurythmy, and what eurythmy puts before us through the physical body is nothing other than listening made visible. You actually do eurythmy when you listen, and when you actually perform eurythmy, you are just making visible what remains invisible when you listen. The manifestation of the activity of the listening human being is, in fact, eurythmy. It is not something arbitrary, but rather the revelation of the activity of the listening human being. People today are, of course, shockingly slovenly. At first, when they listen, they do very poor inner eurythmy. By engaging in it as they should, they raise it to the level of true eurythmy. Through eurythmy, people can learn to listen effectively, which they are presently unable to do. I have made certain unusual discoveries in my recent lectures. Footnote. This refers to Steiner's experiences while lecturing on his proposed, quote, threefold social order, unquote. See, for example, Günter Wachsmuth, The Life and Work of Rudolf Steiner, pages 354 to 361. End of footnote. Speakers come forward during discussions, but from what they have to say, one quickly notices that they really never heard the lecture, not even in the physical sense. They heard only certain parts of it. This is enormously significant, particularly in the present era of our human development. Someone enters into the discussion and says whatever he or she has been used to thinking for decades. You find yourself speaking in front of people with socialist ideas, but they will hear only what they have always heard from certain activists. The rest is not heard, even in the physical sense. Sometimes they innocently admit as much by saying, quote, Dr. Steiner says a lot of good things, but he never says anything new, unquote. People have become so rigid in their listening that they become confused about anything that is not already fossilized gradually within them. People cannot listen, and will become increasingly less able to do so in our age, unless the power of listening can be reawakened by eurythmy. The human soul being must find healing again. It will be particularly important in school to supplement the healthy qualities provided by gymnastics, which benefits the body and everything that takes account only of the physiology of bodily functions. The other important factor is the health of the soul. To provide benefits for the soul requires that gymnastics lessons alternate with eurythmy lessons. Although eurythmy is primarily an art, its health-giving forces will be especially salutary to the students. In eurythmy, they will not simply learn something artistic. Through eurythmy, they will derive the same benefits for their soul as they derive through gymnastics for their body. The way these two disciplines complement each other will be very helpful. It is essential to educate our children in a way that will enable them once again to notice the world around them and their fellow human beings. This is the foundation of all social life. Everyone talks today of social impulses, yet nothing but antisocial urges are to be found among people. Socialism ought to have its roots in the new esteem human beings should gain for one another. But there can be mutual esteem only when people really listen to each other. If we are to become teachers and educators, it will be vastly important that we become attentive to these matters once more. Now that you know that when you say a noun, you dissociate yourself from your environment. When you say an adjective, you unite yourself with your surroundings. And when you say a verb, you blossom out into your environment and move with it. You will speak with quite a different inner emphasis about the noun, the adjective, and the verb than you would if you were not aware of these facts. All this is still only a preliminary discussion and will be continued later. For the moment, I really want to evoke certain ideas, the absence of which might lead to confusion. It is extraordinarily important for us to know what it means for a person to become conscious of the structure of language. In addition, we must develop a feeling for the great wisdom in language. This feeling, too, has all but died out today. Language is far cleverer than any of us. You will surely believe me when I say that the structure of language has not been formed by human beings. Just imagine what would have been the result if people had sat in parliaments in order to decree in their cleverness the structure of language. It would result in something about as clever as our laws. The structure of language, however, is truly more clever than our statutory laws. Inherent in the structure of language is the greatest wisdom, and an extraordinary amount can be learned from the way a people or a tribe speaks. Entering consciously in a living way into the framework of language, we can learn a very great deal from the genius of language itself. It is extremely important to learn how to feel something definite in the activity of the spirits of language. To believe that the genius of language works in the structure of language is of great significance. This feeling can be extended further, to the point where we realize that we human beings speak, but animals cannot yet speak. They have at most the beginnings of articulated speech. In our day and age, when people like to confuse everything, speech is ascribed even to ants and bees. But in the light of reality, this is nonsense. It is all built on a form of judgment to which I have frequently drawn attention. There are some natural philosophers today who consider themselves most wise and say, quote, why should not plants, too, have a will life and a feeling life? Are there not plants, the so-called carnivorous plants, that attract small animals that fly near them and then snap shut on them when they have settled? These are beings that seem to have a will relationship with whatever comes into their vicinity, but we cannot claim that such outward signs are really characteristics of will. When I meet this attitude of mind, I usually use the same form of logic and say, I know something that also waits till a live creature comes near it and then encloses and imprisons it, a mousetrap. The mere workings of a mousetrap might therefore just as well be taken as proof that it possesses life as the nature of the Venus flytrap is taken as proof that it possesses consciousness. We must be profoundly conscious that the power of articulate speech is a human possession. And we must also be aware that of our position in the world compared with the other three kingdoms of nature. When we are conscious of it, we also know that our I is very much bound up with everything that constitutes speech, even though today's way of speaking has become very abstract for us. But I would like to make you aware of something that will give you a new respect for language. In ancient times, in the Jewish culture, for example, though it was yet more pronounced even further back, the priests, or those who administered and represented the cults, would stop speaking when they came to certain concepts while celebrating the rites. They interrupted their speech and communicated the names of high beings, not in words, but in silence, through the appropriate eurythmic gestures. Then they continued the spoken rites. For instance, the name that sounds so abstract to us, rendered in Hebrew as, quote, I am the I am, unquote, was never spoken aloud. The priest spoke only up to the point where this name appeared, made the gesture, and resumed speaking. What was expressed in this gesture was the pronounceable name of God in humankind. Why was this done? If this name had been spoken and repeated straight out, people were so sensitive at that time that they would have been stunned. There were sounds and combinations of sounds in speech that could stun the people of ancient cultures, so great was the effect of such words on them. A state like fainting would have taken them over if such words had been spoken and heard. That is why they spoke of the, quote, unutterable name of God, unquote, which was profoundly significant. Such names could be spoken only by the priests, and even by them only on special occasions, for were they to be spoken before unprepared listeners, heaven and earth would collapse. This means that people would fall unconscious. For this reason, such a name was expressed only in a gesture. Such a feeling is an expression of what speech really is. Today, people thoughtlessly blurt out everything. We can no longer vary the feeling nuances, and it is very rare to find a person who can be moved enough, without being sentimental, to have tears in their eyes when they come across certain passages in a novel, for example. This is today quite atavistic. The lively feeling for what lies in speech and sensitivity to language have become very dulled. This is one of the many things that need to be enlivened again today. When we do enliven it, it will enable us to feel more clearly what we really have in speech. We have speech to thank for much that lives in our I-being, in our feeling of being a personality. Our feelings can rise to a mood almost of prayer. I hear the language around me being spoken, and through the speech the power of I, capital, flows into me. Once you have this feeling for the sanctity of summoning the capital I through speech, you will be able to awaken it in the children by a variety of means. Then, too, you will awaken the feeling of I-being in the children, not in an egoistic manner, but in another way. There are two ways of awakening the feeling of the I-being in a child. Done wrongly, it serves to fan the flames of egoism. Done rightly, it stimulates the will and encourages real selflessness and willingness to live with the outer world. I said these things to you because as teachers and educators, you must be permeated by them. It will be up to you to use them in teaching language and speech. We shall speak tomorrow about how we can permeate them with consciousness to awaken in the children the sense for a consciousness of personality. The end of Lecture 4.